ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
They prayed, they preached, they rebelled. From God Forbid, this is the Religious Rebels podcast. The stories of people who defied empires and sometimes paid with their lives. From Joan of Arc's battlefield visions to Malcolm X's final revelation, we tell the stories of those who defied faith and remade it. Religious Rebels, the original disruptors. Search for God Forbid ABC wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
Welcome to the Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge. And we're talking this week about a challenging figure in philosophy, not the easiest bloke to get along with. Rude and quarrelsome, hypersensitive, given to explosive outbursts of temper, arrogant, disdainful of other philosophers, a terrible misanthropist, a terrible misogynist. And yet, I've spent the past few weeks in the company of this dodgy fellow, and I've very much enjoyed the experience. We were not, I should say, hanging out in person. He died in 1860, but I've been enjoying his company via the medium of biography. The man in question is the German philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer. Born in 1788, he lived and wrote during the high point of European Romanticism, so he was dramatically out of step with his culture, because Schopenhauer himself was about as romantic as a punch in the face, and his work has become emblematic of extreme philosophical pessimism. Schopenhauer believed that life, in essence, is suffering, and that never having been born at all is preferable to slogging one's way through all the disappointments and miseries of human existence. So the philosophy, like the man, can be bleak and somewhat confronting. But I've just finished reading a brand new biography of Arthur Schopenhauer, and it's so full of wonderful detail, so full of fascinating stories, often very entertaining stories, and elegant philosophical analysis, that I come to the end of it finding myself feeling some affection for Schopenhauer, certainly appreciative respect, and I'm determined to go out and explore more of his work. The book is Arthur Schopenhauer, The Life and Thought of Philosophy's Greatest Pessimist, and its author is David Bather Woods, who's an associate professor in the Department of Philosophy at Warwick University in the UK. I want to begin asking you really just why a new book about Schopenhauer, because biographies are interesting in and of themselves, so there's that. But yours is also a book about Schopenhauer's work, his ideas. And what is it about that work and those ideas that makes you feel that Schopenhauer is an important thinker for this day and age?
Well, I guess a simple answer is that we live in quite a pessimistic day and age. People are quite open about the fact that things feel bad, that there are really terrible features of the reality we live in. And Schopenhauer wouldn't be at all surprised by that. In fact, he wouldn't think that that's just a feature of our time specifically. He would say that every time has had its own challenges, that it's kind of embedded and baked into what it is to be human. I guess the important part, though, is that that raises questions about what to do about it. How should we live in the light of those truths? So I wanted to pursue the question of whether Schopenhauer's pessimism is a livable philosophy, and what better way than to think about whether and how he lived out his philosophical principles.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, isn't it? Because he's not offering a way out of pessimism, is he? He's saying that, yes, the world is terrible, and that is just the way it is, and here's how we make sense of it. Or is that sort of how you see him? He's a sort of a diagnostician, but not a therapist.
Yeah, I do see him that way. So one difference he has with some of the sort of Hellenistic schools that are very popular in self-help at the moment, like Stoicism, is that they wanted to develop a way to live a good and happy earthly life. And for Schopenhauer, that's just not possible. If he has any form of escape at all that you could call a form of escape, it's something more radical, like actually trying to uproot the origin of suffering in ourselves. He was actually, in this respect, closer to, say, Buddhism, which he admired deeply. So at most, Schopenhauer is going to offer us some way of kind of keeping our serenity and tranquility in a world of chaos and madness, rather than a way of kind of ameliorating all those things. He doesn't think they can be ameliorated.
I love reading the biographies of philosophers. I think it's always fascinating to put context around the ideas. But the problem with doing that is that you, either as a reader or a writer, you can easily fall into a sort of pop psychoanalysis where you say, oh, Schopenhauer's father killed himself. That explains why he was so dark and pessimistic. Or, oh, his mother was mean to him. That explains his misogyny. Where, you know, the life just becomes a series of causes whose effects turn up in the philosophy. How do you approach that problem as a biographer? Because on one hand, it's important not to simply reduce the ideas to the biography. But on the other hand, it seems like there has to be a relationship there. Like the man and the work are to some degree shaped by the same set of circumstances, whether those circumstances are personal or cultural or political or intellectual or whatever. So how do you walk that line? Is that something that was very much on your mind as you were writing the book?
Yeah, it absolutely was. I didn't want to give an excessively biographical reading of his ideas, even though it is very tempting. You can pinpoint parts of his philosophy that it's very tempting to read in the light of the things that happened in his life. So one way to avoid that was to try to flip it, which is to say, well, instead of reading the ideas in the light of the life events, why not try to read the life events in the light of the ideas? So if Schopenhauer is going through a terrible time because, as you mentioned, his father chose suicide when Schopenhauer was only 17, then rather than try and explain Schopenhauer's views on suicide as a function of that life event, why not take Schopenhauer's views on suicide and use that to interpret and analyze what Schopenhauer might have been going through when those things occurred? So to flip it and look at the light in the life of the ideas was one way I tried to avoid that hazard. The other was just to, as you mentioned, use the life just as context, not as a kind of sufficient explanation of the ideas, certainly not as a basis of evaluating them. That would be a fallacy to say, well, they can't be any good because there's a very simple explanation why he thought that way. That's, you know, pure and simply the genetic fallacy. But still, when looked at in context, some of Schopenhauer's more radical ideas actually turn out to be things that lots of people were thinking about at the time. And similarly, sometimes he has ideas that are very surprising, and you wouldn't think that Schopenhauer would have thought those things. So even I sometimes was taken aback by some of the things that he said that surprised me that I didn't know about until researching the book.
Well, let's continue that approach for this conversation. We'll consider some of the key ideas in Schopenhauer's philosophy and then use those as a lens through which to view some key episodes or passages in his life. The first one I wanted to talk about is this notorious pessimism. He has running through his work this idea that existence is driven by a blind, relentless will, this force that ultimately condemns all beings to suffering. It's bracing stuff. What does he mean by that? What's the connection between will and suffering there?
This gets to the heart of Schopenhauer's wider philosophy, which is that he thinks that the essence of human beings is actually an essence that we share with all natural beings, namely what he calls the will to life, this blind striving for existence, this struggle at all costs to remain in being. And unfortunately, when you are a conscious being, like human beings and non-human animals, that striving is felt very painfully. I mean, he thinks it's almost a logical inevitability because when you strive for something, of necessity, you lack it, otherwise you wouldn't be striving for it. And it has to be a painful lack, otherwise you wouldn't have the motivation to pursue it. If you lacked it but didn't care, then you wouldn't want to go out and get it. And so our experience of the will to life is necessarily a painful one. And satisfaction is all too brief, because once we satisfy our desires, there will be, you know, 10 or a dozen to replace it. There'll be another worry to come along, and that'll be the next thing we focus on. And so if we even stop to feel happy at all, it passes us by very quickly. And so we're involved in this cycle of desire in a way that, again, is very reminiscent of more classical Indian and East Asian philosophies like Buddhism and Hinduism. And so that allows him to establish the kind of first tenet of pessimism, which is that all of life is essentially suffering. There's a second, deeper tenet of pessimism, which he derives from that, which is the far more strong claim that existence is a mistake, that we ought not to live, that it would be better never to have been born. He says things to that effect, and he's very much not the first person to say that. He might be the first person to put that on a philosophical footing under the banner of the word pessimism, which is a relatively new term in his day. But as he quotes, because he's very literate, from Socrates to Shakespeare, people have been saying or playing around with ideas like that. Famously, Shakespeare, you know, in Hamlet's soliloquy, to be or not to be. These are famous expositions of the core idea that it would be better not to exist. So that's how willing the will to life ends up being connected to these deep pessimistic doctrines.
Implications there for free will as well, right? He writes that a man can do what he wills to do, but he cannot determine what he wills. That's really central here as well, yeah?
Yeah, at least on one level, he's a kind of hard determinist. So he does think that once you have a character and once you have a set of circumstances, the outcome necessarily follows. And so he writes actually an essay in the kind of middle period of his work. In the late 1830s, he writes an essay called On the Freedom of the Will, which wins a prize awarded to him by the Royal Norwegian Society of Sciences. And then he publishes it as part of a two-part work, The Two Fundamental Problems of Ethics in the Early 1840s. There is a bit of a Kantian inflection, though, because Schopenhauer was very influenced by Immanuel Kant, and Kant had some interesting thoughts about the nature of character and made distinctions between different kinds of character. So whereas the empirical character, that is the character that appears in life, is thoroughly determined, to Kantians, there is a kind of transcendental freedom, a kind of choice to be the person you are that happens outside of time. And right at the end of this essay, Schopenhauer kind of almost pulls the rug from under us and says, but you still choose your character. And the reason why he says that partly is to explain a psychological fact, which is that even though he thinks hard determinism is true, we still feel responsible for who we are. So that's an interesting question. Why do we feel responsible for who we are? He thinks because ultimately we do choose to be who we are, or at least we choose either to affirm life or to deny life. And that's something we feel responsible for despite our actions being determined.
Looking at the life, we see a lot of suffering. I mean, he's a lonely figure from an early age. At the age of 17, as you mentioned, he loses his father to an apparent suicide. Very hostile relationship with his mother. As he gets older, he's frustrated by academic failure. He has a lot of bitterness around that. Let's do some of that reverse psychologizing. I mean, how do any of these aspects of his life illustrate his point about will and suffering?
I think they do, in the sense that although all of those examples are specific to Schopenhauer, not everyone, fortunately, not everyone loses their father to suicide. Not everyone has a difficult relationship with their mother or with their other parent. Not everyone experiences academic failures in the specifics, but everybody will have their own version of that. It isn't an accident that Schopenhauer encountered so many setbacks in his life. The details differ, but the general trend, the general pattern is the same, which is everybody has their own setbacks. And that isn't an accident. It actually comes from us. Again, it goes back to the subjective conditions of this. It goes back to the fact that we are restless creatures that are always wanting more out of life and wanting to pursue things. And that will inevitably create barriers that will inevitably come up against something that we want and can't have. He has a nice line, which is that viewed up close, every life is a tragedy. And viewed from afar, every life is a comedy, because it's almost comical. It's kind of ironic. It's almost tragic that the things that we encounter in life and think they're just accidents of, oh, what bad luck I have. It's actually a kind of big joke that the universe is playing on, is that it was always set up, it was always rigged from the start that you were going to encounter these sorts of sufferings.
In The World as Will and Representation, his great work, Schopenhauer writes about love and desire and romantic passion, on all of which he takes a characteristically jaundiced perspective. What does he have to say about love? I think he's so interesting here.
Yeah, so he has, well, I guess I would distinguish between two forms of love in Schopenhauer, and what we're talking about now is romantic love. The other form, I guess, we'd call moral love, not that he calls it that, but that's he defines as compassion, but maybe we'll talk about that later. Romantic love for Schopenhauer, he's quite reductivist about this. He thinks that romantic love is just nothing else but the sex drive in disguise. It's a kind of romantic soap bubble that propels us to suitable romantic partners with whom we can procreate and have, you know, fit offspring. So it becomes very reductionist and almost evolutionary psychology in its way. The thing is, though, you might think that that's Schopenhauer trying to characterize romantic love as somehow frivolous and unreal or something like that. But he actually resists that line. He thinks this makes it as real and as serious as anything. It's a very serious task to try to bring forth the next generation of human beings and bring them forth in a quote-unquote fit condition. And so what he's trying to do is not try to belittle romantic love, but to explain why it's pursued with such urgency. The thing is, that task, if you were to put it to somebody without giving them a kind of personal incentive, they might say, what do I care what the next generation of human beings look like? And so it has to be masked by this instinct, which makes it look like not only is this going to produce offspring for the next generation, but also it's in your personal interest. It's going to make you happy. The thing is, once nature has kind of had its way and achieved its aims, that romantic soap bubble suddenly pops. And there Schopenhauer explains why romance is pursued with such dogged intensity, but then followed by such disillusionment.
So romance is a sort of an illusion or a trick of the will, if you like. Is that how you'd describe it?
Absolutely. That's kind of how he'd see it, that it's nature's way of getting us to go along with its grand plan. He does have moments of lightness in that, though. He distinguishes between romantic love and friendly love. Friendly love would be where the actual psychological temperaments of two people are in harmony with one another. And generally, he sees it as a kind of second option. If you're not romantic partners, then you might achieve what's actually more in your personal interest, which is friendly love. But then he sometimes says, if you're really lucky, the person who nature wants to kind of match you with in the eyes of the species happens to have complementary and harmonious qualities with you. And if you get that, then, you know, everything is in sync in that you'll also have a friend as well as a lover. So he does think it's possible, although he says such marriages are rare. So he's a little bit skeptical about how many people achieve that, but it is technically possible in his view.
Yeah, I mean, he's sort of strikingly out of step with his culture here, isn't he? Because it's quite a sentimental culture, the culture of his day. And this is the early 19th century, the high point of European romanticism. But he never marries. He does have two children, but they die in infancy. And in neither case are they the fruit of a deep love affair. He doesn't seem like the best example of the will using love and sexual desire as a cover for the biological imperative to reproduce.
No, that's right. He's not fulfilling his obligations to nature. He's not producing offspring that survive infancy. He's not partnering up with anyone. So he's not a shining example of that. But actually, he might consider that something of a success, because remember, going back to this point, that what we should ultimately try and do for Schopenhauer is to try and break free of the kind of desires of the will, that this might be a good thing, that he's actually not falling into lockstep with the rest of nature. So he might pass that off as an achievement rather than a failure, although it probably felt like a failure too.
Well, I wonder. I mean, it's tempting to speculate that he had a fear of intimacy, but yeah. In the philosophy, I mean, it seems like there's a sense in which he's striving for a kind of asceticism, which refuses the will, you know, trying to live beyond the will in some way, which I guess is what you're saying.
Maybe. I mean, I would definitely say he had an aversion to intimacy. I don't know whether it was necessarily motivated by fear, because he thinks that intimacy brings along with it quite a lot of imperatives. If you have these kind of thick relationships with another person, whether it's with a friend or a family member, you owe them a lot of your time, of your material support, of your loyalty. And he actually seems to think that these would have a distorting influence on his independence of mind, on his ability to produce genuinely sort of unbiased work that wasn't distorted by aims of, for instance, trying to make a living to support a family and so on. That's an interesting way of thinking about it, because there were other men of his day who would see a family as in the opposite way, which is that they're there to support the man or what have you, to make sure that he is well looked after and so on. But instead, he seems to think that if he were to have these sorts of intimate relationships, it would get in the way of the life he wanted to live. So, I mean, that makes it seem like a deliberate choice. Another explanation is this is just part of his disposition. When he reflects on his nature, he seems to think he's quite solitary by disposition, that he likes to be alone with his thoughts and things like that. That's his kind of idea of happiness. And in terms of whether he was living an ascetic life, when you look in the details, I suppose he's not denying himself many other pleasures. He denied himself kind of intimacy, I suppose, but, you know, he liked his small pleasures. He liked to play the flute. He liked to have a meal out. He liked to have, you know, rich table conversation with a, you know, collection of somewhat intimate friends, but not necessarily totally close. He liked to go out and, you know, see the opera. So he liked to travel in his earlier years. So he wasn't living the life of the Buddha exactly, put it that way.
Yeah. And two children out of wedlock.
That's true.
Let's not forget.
But so did Marx and so did Hegel. So, and they were married.
This is the Philosopher's Zone on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen. I'm David Rutledge, and I'm talking this week with David Bather Woods from the University of Warwick in the UK. David is the author of a brand new biography of the philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer, which is just a terrific read, and you can find publication details on the Philosopher's Zone website. An interesting thing which you write about in the book is that Schopenhauer is interested in same-sex attraction, which he sees as confounding or at least complicating the idea of love as being driven by the need to procreate. It's an interesting thing to me that he's interested in that. How does he explain homosexuality?
Yeah, it is an interesting one. It's a relatively late development in his thought. So it appears in the third edition of his main work, The World as a Representation, which is published in 1859, which is the year before he dies. So it's a very late edition. And to a chapter called On the Metaphysics of Sexual Love, he adds an appendix about a specific form of homosexuality, which has a long and venerated history, namely the kind of classical Greek model of what Schopenhauer was calling pederasty, which is a bit of an archaic term, can even be used as a homophobic term today, so we have to be somewhat careful with it. But he tries to explain why is it that same-sex relationships have happened all throughout history, including in some of the greatest civilizations in history, when it seems that they are not in line with nature's supposed aim of procreation, given that two males, a young boy and a man, can't procreate naturally with one another, it would seem. So his explanation for that actually makes use of the fact that pederasty in particular is a age-differentiated sexuality. So there's two age groups. There's the younger man and there's the older man. And his explanation then is that nature is trying to satisfy the sexual desires of both parties. In one case, an under-mature male who's not mature enough to reproduce, and an over-mature male who is, you know, too far gone to produce healthy offspring. So it's a kind of natural accommodation of the sexual instincts of these men who are not, in his view, fit to reproduce. So they have sex with one another instead. Now, for lots of people, that would be a very unsatisfactory explanation and a very specific, because it doesn't take into account female same-sex relationships. It doesn't take into account age equal relationship, same-sex relationships. But the important thing is that he ends this chapter by saying that he defends and recommends this form of sexuality because in the eyes of, you know, it's serving nature's goal. But more importantly, I suppose he's by extension saying it shouldn't be suppressed. And in the later 19th century, when Germany actually was leading the way in new thinking about same-sex relationships and rights for same-sex partners, they took some inspiration from Schopenhauer's openness to not suppressing this form of sexuality because it might have its place in nature as well as society.
Yeah, very interesting. I mean, not something that you would expect to get away with easily in early 19th century Germany, though, is it? And, you know, it's interesting to me that he never goes in for the language of degeneracy or sin. He finds homosexuality metaphysically interesting, but he's quite morally tolerant, or that's how it seems. I mean, how does he get away with that in his time?
Yeah, it's complicated. I mean, to be honest, he kind of gives with one hand, takes away with the other, because he does sometimes characterize it in ways that would today make you wince. You know, he's not totally admirable in this respect, but he tries to make it that it's not a moral matter so long as both parties can give meaningful consent to it. Ultimately, for Schopenhauer, to wrong somebody, you have to violate their will. You have to affirm your will in such a way that encroaches on theirs. Now, if you have sexual practices that are purely self-concerning, for instance, he didn't think there was anything morally wrong with, he was calling it onanism, we would say masturbation. There's nothing morally wrong with it, because it only concerns one person and presumably that person consents. He did go in for some slightly weird 19th century medical myths, thinking that it was bad for your health, but that's a totally different prudential ground, you know, to resist those sorts of practices. And similarly, consistently applied at any rate, if two partners, whether they be same sex or not, consent to this practice, well, then nobody, there's a kind of no harm, no foul rule that he's implying here, that then that's not a moral matter. We might judge it differently on other grounds. You know, it might be from a sort of the perspective of procreation or what have you, but in terms of actual injury, there is none done so long as everybody consents. So that's the way he tries to diffuse the moral charge of that issue.
And I guess relying on a sort of classical template as well, which is, you know, that template has been there for centuries. It's kind of a safe way in which to talk about this topic. And is that part of it as
That's absolutely part of it. And that's one of the two main strategies that actually was more associated with Britain. There were lots of British thinkers who, so John Addington Symonds, for instance, Symonds was a person who was trying to study homosexuality or gayness, being himself a gay man, through a classical lens, giving it some sort of legitimacy by saying, and also some distance by saying, look, this is a practice that's happened in the cultures that we venerate. The other strategy, which Schopenhauer doesn't take so much, but that was actually very prominent in Germany in the later 19th century, was studying it as a medical phenomenon. And again, in Britain too. So John Addington Symonds, regular co-author Havelock Ellis, was looking at it more from a medical perspective, and he would interview men about their experiences and be able to analyze them from a health perspective as well as an ethical one. So yes, giving it some legitimacy, some putting it on a footing that perhaps the public would be more familiar with, was another strategy for being able to discuss these things in public.
There is a deep vein of misogyny running through his work. He wrote an essay about women titled On Women, in which he makes some highly offensive claims. What does he have to say about women in that essay?
Yeah, there is a lot in that essay that's rather regrettable, rather embarrassing to the Schopenhauer scholar, because he doesn't hide his misogyny. And he's not just a man of his times here. You know, there were men of his day who were far ahead of the game when it came to women's rights and things like that. We could name all sorts of philosophers who were starting to show solidarity with feminism and so on. Now, Schopenhauer thinks that women are naturally inferior to men. He's very upright, you know, kind of forthcoming about that. And therefore, the social equality that women have achieved in recent years in Europe, he thinks, puts them in a false position, that they've been placed somewhere that they ought not to be, which is obviously something that we wouldn't accept these days. And when I discuss this with my students, which I do, they are disappointed that Schopenhauer didn't see that the inequality that he'd spotted between men and women was a socially generated one rather than a natural circumstance. Because once you actually look at it through a social lens, there's a lot in Schopenhauer that's potentially redeemable. And an ironic afterlife of Schopenhauer's work is that he was read by feminists. Like, some people have argued that the title, The Second Sex, of Simone de Beauvoir's great philosophical masterpiece actually comes from her having read Schopenhauer, who uses this phrase. It is a classical reference, but who uses this phrase a few times in his essay, not just because you know, Beauvoir doesn't just pick up on him because he's the ideal enemy, the ideal target, but because he had one or two interesting observations about the inequality of men and women and the ways that, in particular, the marriage institution didn't serve either of their interests.
His ideas aren't merely social prejudice. I mean, they stem from his philosophy, from this metaphysics of the will. Mm. How is that the case? And how do we see it borne out in some of his relationships with women?
Yes. I mean, there's one theory he has about the inheritance of, he thinks that the character is inherited from the father and the intellect inherited from the mother. Now, you might think that's a wild and weird theory. He actually gathers quite a lot of source material to support that. So it wasn't him going out on a limb in his day to have thought that. You might think at first that that's quite a compliment, that he's actually attributed intellect to women, but actually it kind of repeats an age-old trope that we find in misogynistic material, which is that in Schopenhauer's view, it's the will that predominates in nature. And it's the intellect that is merely an instrument of the will. And so even by calling women the kind of progenitors of the intellect and men the progenitors of character, he is expressing the same dynamic of men's dominance over the will and women existing to serve men's interests. I suppose if we're going to indulge in a little bit of a kind of autobiographical reading of Schopenhauer here, it is interesting that his mother was herself a very intellectual woman. You know, she had her salon where Goethe attended it in Weimar. She wrote really successful travelogues and books and novels and diaries. And so it serves Schopenhauer's purpose. If we're going to read him a bit biographically, it serves his purpose too to think that he inherited his mother's intellect as well as his father's industrious character. So there's a little bit of a biographical origin of that one, if we'll allow it.
I mean, he doesn't seem to have been an out-and-out misogynist in his life, does he? His relationship with his sister, for example, yeah, I find really interesting.
I agree. It was one of the pleasures of writing the book to learn more about his sister, Adele Schopenhauer, who was, like Johanna Schopenhauer's mother, was an extremely talented woman, very artistic, and actually very, very kind person, and spent a lot of time, often over letters, because they were still physically quite distant from one another, taking care of Schopenhauer's feelings a little bit. And when Schopenhauer found out that Adele, even though she was his younger sister, had died in 1849 after a long period of ill health, he was pretty devastated by that. His sister really did mean a lot to him. If he had one intimate relationship in his life, it was definitely the deep affection he had for his sister. So there's that. And that's one, apart from the fact that it was really fun to learn more about Adele Schopenhauer, and I think more people should know about her, it was one endearing and redeeming quality I could find in Schopenhauer's biography that makes you feel a little bit more warm to him despite his limitations, that he had this really quite sweet relationship with his sister eventually.
And then on the other side of the coin, you have this terrible event that happened with a seamstress, I believe,
yes.
Caroline Marquet.
Yeah,
that's tell us about that.
That's something that one of the stories that precedes Schopenhauer is that when he was living in Berlin in the 1820s, which was a really rough period in his life because he was working at the University of Berlin at the height of Hegel's fame and renown. And he was very much in Hegel's shadow and not getting many people to come to his own lectures. And there's a point where he comes home and this neighbor in his building, seamstress, is stood with her friends sort of chatting outside his door. And he says, well, what are you doing here? You know, there's no reason for you to need to be here. Can you move on? And then he comes out later and they're still not gone. And he's off out and he says, oh, let me lead you out. And she refuses. And eventually he starts to get angry and physically violent. He tries to physically move her away from the door and she ends up falling over and he throws her belongings after her. And she does file a suit against him. After a series of kind of counterclaims and appeals, she wins that suit and he has to pay her a kind of annual alimony for the rest of her life because she claims in the suit that she's no longer able to conduct her work. It's a very, of all the stories in Schopenhauer's life, it's one of, sadly, the more famous, and it's one of the ones that shows him in the least flattering light, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, let's bring him back a little bit from the brink there, because I wanted to ask you about his work on morality and something you mentioned earlier, which is that much of his ethics hinges on compassion. He's a great champion of kindness to animals and yet notoriously contemptuous towards people. Not all people all the time, but certainly by and large, he's a terrible misanthrope. How do we reconcile the misanthropy with this ethic of compassion, which is so strong in his work?
Ethics for Schopenhauer is firmly based on compassion, where compassion is defined as an incentive to help others, or rather not harm others, and to show kindness to others by trying to alleviate their sufferings when you see it. So he just differs very much from Kant, for instance. He doesn't think that ethics lies in obeying principles or abstract duties. He's different from the utilitarians. He's not trying to maximize some sort of measure of general utility. It's a completely different way of judging what moral action consists in, that it consists in this particular form of compassion. And he's very firm on that. So that's the kind of, when I was saying there's a kind of moral love in Schopenhauer, at one point he says that all genuine love is compassion. So he thinks it's a very meaningful form of a moral action as well. Now, how does that sit with, as you characterize it quite, you know, accurately, as his misanthropic nature? Well, there's one quite simple way to resolve that, which is that Schopenhauer's misanthropy consisted in a negative judgment of the worth and value of human beings. He thought that most human beings were, as individuals, were pretty worthless, were pretty valueless, that they had so many flaws and limitations that inevitably generated a negative opinion about them. But for Schopenhauer, that has nothing to do with compassion, because for him, compassion is not based on judgments of somebody's worth and value in that sense. Compassion is based on a recognition of the suffering of that person, of their misery, of their pain, which explains why we can have compassion for our enemies. Even though we think somebody's wretchedly depraved, we can still think that when they're suffering, we can still be motivated deeply to try to end their suffering, to alleviate their suffering, maybe within the limits of that justice allows. But for Schopenhauer, compassion is not merit-based. Compassion is based on just recognition of the suffering of the other and being moved in such a way as to end their suffering. And so in the eulogy that one of his closer followers, Wilhelm Gwinner, who actually wrote the first biography in German of Schopenhauer, in his eulogy, Gwinner says that Schopenhauer, people knew him as a misanthrope, but that was to see him only superficially. Although he had a low opinion of human beings, he felt for them very deeply. And you can see his whole philosophy as a deep feeling, a deep sympathy with the plight of the human condition. So that's the way I sort of try to reconcile the compassion ethics with the reputation for misanthropy.
It's nice to see that he does become something of a celebrity toward the end of his life, which is great. You know, after years of intense frustration and bitterness in this stalled academic career, the lonely outsider finally has success and fans and admirers. How does he deal with that? I mean, does that soften the misanthropy a little?
I think it does, to a degree, for sure. So his rise to fame really starts in the 1850s, which is the last decade of his life. And in 1851, he publishes his last main work, which is Perega and Paralipomena, which is a fancy Greek word. I roughly translate it as offshoots and offcuts. You know, it's some spin-offs from his main system, as well as some sort of retreading of old ground and reformulation of his views. But this, it's written in a way that's a little bit more worldly, a little bit more open. It's actually harvested from lots of notebooks he's been keeping for decades. And it's quite frankly, much more readable than any philosophy that's out there, certainly in comparison to his peers. And so in 1853, a couple of years later, he gets his first big international review, which is in the Westminster Review, which was a journal that was founded by Jeremy Bentham and at one point was edited by John Stuart Mill. But at the time it published this review of Schopenhauer's works, it was actually effectively edited by the novelist George Eliot before she became really renowned in her own right. Although at the time she was a big translator and scholar of German philosophy and culture. And they write this rave review saying, finally, a German who we can understand, you know, he's not so impenetrable as Hegel or even Kant. And he's connected to these really profound issues of what it means to be human and how we live, how we ought to live our lives. And it launches him into some amount of fame. He has it translated into German and published by one of his associates. And so for the next 7 years until he dies, he starts to get visitors to his apartment in Frankfurt. People come to take his picture. I make a big point in the biography that photography was invented in his lifetime. And in your answer to your question, does it make him happy? I mean, there's evidence that it does. Some of the reports of his friends and some of his own testimony suggest that, I guess the word is relax. It allowed him to relax. It allowed him to realize that the thing that he thought was really worth saying was finally being heard. And he thought he was getting a taste of a fame that, he was right, turned out to be lasting, because here we are talking about him still, a century or two later after his death. So he was right that once people did catch on to him, it would be something that stays in the memory of human beings for a long time.
And that point about the accessibility of his work that his reviewers made, maybe that's a good point on which to end, because I think if you can stomach the ideas, he is actually a great read, or at least he is in the English translation that I've encountered him in. Is that just a happy accident, or is it that he really wanted to communicate as directly as possible to a wide readership, and he knew how to do it?
Yeah, I think in a way it was inevitable that he was going to be such a great stylist. I think that's partly to do with the fact that he was somewhat of an outsider in that he didn't have, you know, a successful academic career. He left his Berlin career in the early 1830s. Also, in his earlier life, he was trained in different languages, including French, including English, as well as German. So he was reading lots of French authors, English authors, particularly Hume and Locke, and this kind of common sense idiom of English philosophy, and sort of importing that into the technical precision of German philosophy and so on. And he didn't have an agenda that he had to promote. So he didn't have to, because he wasn't kind of writing philosophy for a living, he could more or less set what it is that he wanted to talk about and how he wanted to present it. So he had a lot of freedom as well as a lot of skill in this domain. And so when you read Schopenhauer, he can be extremely entertaining. He can be witty and funny. He can be sarcastic and scathing. He can tell these engaging stories, and he's always got a really good eye for these new stories or kind of symbols in nature that illustrate his thoughts that make it seem so concrete, less kind of abstract and analytical than his peers and certainly later generations of philosophy, which is why, in terms of his legacy, it was actually a lot of literary artists who appreciated him most. So Samuel Beckett, Marcel Proust, Thomas Hardy, Jorge Luis Borges. I've mentioned Simone de Beauvoir, Iris Murdoch, who calls Schopenhauer the merry pessimist, because he has this confusing effect, which is that his message is very dark and depressing, arguably, but the style is very invigorating. And you come away feeling not depressed, but actually even more engaged and fascinated by the world. So I do think his style is one of the reasons why he's still so appreciated.
Well, you've written an invigorating book yourself, David. I've really enjoyed it, and I've really enjoyed this conversation. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. Thank you.
David Bather Woods. He's an associate professor in the Department of Philosophy at Warwick University in the UK and the author of Arthur Schopenhauer, The Life and Thought of Philosophy's Greatest Pessimist. Publication details on the website. This has been The Philosopher's Zone, produced on Bundjalung Country by me, David Rutledge. You can catch up with past Philosopher's Zone episodes via ABC Listen, and I do hope you can join me again next week. Bye for now.